أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله حي على الصلاة حي على الصلاة حي على الفلاح حي على الفلاح قد قامت الصلاة قد قامت الصلاة الله أكبر الله أكبر لا إله إلا الله
Sufficiency or Mukammal Farmare. Please complete the source and straighten the rows, fill in all the gaps. Allahu Akbar. الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Allahu Akbar. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Sweat brothers, inshallah, after the dua, the part two of the series, Muslim, the history of the Muslims in Spain, will be delivered by Maulana Adil Tagari, inshallah. Yesterday we had the part one, today the part two will be delivered. All brothers, I kindly request you to participate. Jazakallah. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sallam. Ramadan wa salam. لا إله إلا أنت سبحانك إنا كنا من الظالمين. اللهم أنت السلام منك السلام تبارك يا هذا الجلال والإكرام. اللهم إنا على ذكرك وشكرك وحسن عبادتك. اللهم لا مانع لما أعطيت ولا معطي لما منعت ولا ينفع ذا الجد منك الجد. اللهم إنا نعوذ بك من عذاب جهنم ونعوذ بك من عذاب القبر ونعوذ بك من فتنة المحيا والممات ونعوذ بك من شر سبحان ربك رب العزة عما يصفون وسلام على المرسلين والحمد لله.
Brothers, I kindly request you to come forward close to the member. Jazakallah. Brothers, please come forward, inshallah. Part two of the history of Maulana Sahib. He started speaking about the Spain, the history of Spain, 600-700 years where Muslims ruled, and the rise and the fall of Spain, how the Muslims, and what are the lessons we can take from these the times that Muslims had ruled for in Spain, and how we can learn their lessons. As we know, the masajis there, you know, the famous places of Cordoba, Allama Qurtubi and many other places where the masajis have become a place just for visitors and places of tourists. So, mashallah, we have many masajid around England. You know, we need to learn lessons from these history, Muslim history, where we don't fall into the same trap or we don't go down the same road as those Muslims did. Inshallah, Maulana will explain all these things in detail. I will pass over to Maulana Sahib now, inshallah. Maulana Adil Takari.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. We begin by praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Most High, whose wisdom spans the earth and the sky. Nations rise and empires fall. By His decree, He governs all. In history's ebb and flow we see His signs and lessons, His clear decree. From dust to glory, then decline, all in His perfect grand design. May we find wisdom in His way and walk the path He sets each day. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brothers who are here and brothers and sisters who are listening at home, if I can ask people who are joining just to close in the gaps and move a little bit closer, if you're going to be joining in today. Jazakumullah. So, I think numbers have whittled down a little bit from yesterday. I was hoping some of the same attendees would be here because I wanted to carry on with the trivia that we started yesterday. So I think we'll leave out the duos and we can do this individually. So what I wanted to do was, for the first 5 minutes, we'll go through a very simple Q&A format. I'll give you the questions and you can write down the answer. And I think we've got the pad and got some pens over here as well. So the idea is, if I can pique your curiosity a little bit with these very simple questions, and then I won't reveal the answers until the end. You might have to remind me in case I forget. And that'll give you a little bit of time in between to amend and modify the answers if you need to. And they should be relatively simple because we covered quite a few of them yesterday. Inshallah today, we hope to end at 9:15. I know yesterday we did go straight to the wire, but inshallah I'll stick to the time limit. 5 minutes here and there is a buffer zone, I'm sure people won't mind. Okay, so number one, this should be very simple. What was the capital of Muslim Spain? This should be an easy one. Yeah, you can write it down. What was the capital of Muslim Spain? And I'm hoping, because yesterday we covered the chronology and you've registered it into your brains, then you might want to amend the question by saying, well, we had different dynasties, we had different empires and states that ruled, so which one are you talking about? So I'll narrow it down, the Umayyads. Because if you can remember, who came after the Umayyads? Let me pick at your brains here. Okay, no, this is a question that I want you to answer here. It's not part of the trivia. Who came after the Umayyads? The Abbasids in the east, right? We're talking about in the west. So you had the Murabitun, not yet. You had the what's known as the Ta'ifa period. So the small statelets, where central authority fragmented, and then as soon as the Umayyad state pretty much exploded, or rather imploded, then you had around 24 smaller states, and everybody wanted their own piece of land, and there was everybody was fighting each other for small scraps of territory. So obviously you can't have a capital when every single state was confined to a city. So each city was its own kingdom and its own capital. So that's redundant. The Al-Murabitun, the Berber dynasty, the first one, they didn't actually have their capital in Spain because they never originated from Spain. They came from North Africa. And their capital was, popular holiday destination today, Marrakesh. Mashallah. It's not part of the trivia, so you don't get a point for that, unfortunately. So Marrakesh. Then after that, they were replaced by another Berber dynasty, the Al-Muwahidun, or the Almohads. So they lasted only around 70 years, Almoravids, and the Almohads came. And the Almohads again, their capital was based in North Africa. It was the exact same city, by the way, Marrakesh. And there was a very brutal takeover of Marrakesh from the Almoravids. All the men were put to the sword, women and children were enslaved. This is Muslim on Muslim fighting, by the way. And then obviously you had the final state, Nasrids, and they were confined and pretty much hemmed into Granada. So again, we can't really have a capital if it's restricted to only one state. So, the Umayyad capital. You can write down that one. Question number two. There are only about 6 or 7 questions here. Question number two. Which Muslim dynasty ruled the majority of Spain for the majority of the medieval period? We covered this yesterday as well. So which Muslim dynasty ruled the majority of Spain, Muslim Spain, for the majority of the medieval period? Hint, I just mentioned it a few minutes ago. Just mentioned it a few minutes ago. Okay, that's number two. Number three. Let me ask this question again. Is anybody here going to Spain with Nur Islam?
Maybe.
Okay, got one brother. We're going to assume.
When is it and what's the itinerary and all that? I mean, I don't know.
It's on the poster. The dates.
Don't look at the poster.
It's just a notice board. I'm getting up for you.
At the end of July, right? Or?
At the end of July.
So I guess there's still time.
There's still time to book.
But we'll assume the rest of them are listening from home on e-masjid. So what's the name? And I'm sure you might have heard of this, you might not have, but I'm banking on the fact that you have. What was the name of the famous palace complex and fortress in Granada? You're right, actually. You're right, but I want the name for it. No, you're right. Brother's right. He's on the right tracks here, but I want the Arabic name. Well, the Arabic name or the anglicized, Hispanicized name, whichever one will work. And this is one of the two most visited tourist attractions in Spain. At the top of Spain's tourist attractions, you have two Muslim sites, and they're both UNESCO World Heritage Sites as well. Number four, this is one of only two dates that I expected you to write down, remember from yesterday. Which year did Muslim rule begin in Spain? In which year? It's all right, that confused look on your face, it'll turn to delight at the end. Don't worry about that. So which year did Muslim rule begin in Spain? Got a few more. Number five, who was the first Amir or independent ruler in Cordoba? The first independent Muslim ruler in Cordoba. The first Amir. I'm not going to say anything, but okay, we've got one more. This is the other major attraction in Spain. So we had the palace fortress complex in Granada. And then we have the sixth, I think is the sixth question.
Yeah.
So which significant cultural, intellectual, and religious center was located in Cordoba? If I say anything more, then I'll be giving it away. It'll be a dead giveaway. Intellectual, cultural, and religious center all combined into one. I'll give you another hint. It was grossly defaced and morphed, transfigured during the 16th century. It was a structure.
Grossly,
outrageously defaced.
No.
Like gross as in disgusting, it was. But yeah, okay, the pun, I get it. you're even ahead of me, brother. Yeah, so crossly, grossly, yeah, in both ways. Okay, so we'll revisit this, just keep it with you, we'll revisit this towards the end. So we've already touched upon the chronology. I'm not going to bore you with more facts and figures and statistics. What we want to do now is, again, we're going to work chronologically, but I'm just going to pick apart a couple of events that have taken place, and then we can translate some of their lessons into the modern world. So, number one is, this is part of the answer, so I'm not going to say it. When the Muslims first landed in Spain, the force was commanded by a Berber general who was a governor of the city of Tangiers in Morocco, known as Tariq ibn Ziyad. And he landed at a monolithic rock, which was empty. It was barren, desolate, nothing there. And he set up his forces there, command center, HQ. And then he started to launch the first couple of scouting and reconnaissance missions from there. And it was sort of a mountain. So the mountain was given the name Jabal al-Tariq, the mountain of Tariq. He owned it. And over time, the name was corrupted into Gibraltar. So Tariq ibn Ziyad made his way there with a contingent of around 12,000, 8,000, 9,000 Berber soldiers, maybe a handful of Arabs. So these Berbers weren't Arabs. And they didn't come from the Arabian Peninsula, they originated from North Africa. And this is an episode from Muslim history which is worth writing in gold, and you should maybe ingrain it onto your hearts. So when his troops were ferried from Ceuta, which is in North Africa, and they landed at Jabal al-Tariq, and then they were taken to Al-Jasira. So in Spain today, if you can remember what I said yesterday, for the most part, any word in southern Spain that begins with an A-L, that's an identifying marker of its Arab origins. So the city was originally known as Al-Jaziratul Khadra, which is the green, luscious, and vegetative peninsula. Or it was just a city that was green and it was filled with all sorts of vegetation. And then it was corrupted into Spain, in the Spanish language, as Al-Jasira. So A-L-G-E-C-I-R-A-S. So again, it has clear Arab origins. So the moment all of his troops landed, he made a very daring, brave, some would even say foolish, idiotic move. He turned around, he faced all of the ferries and the merchantmen that carried them over, and he set them alight. He burned them. And there was a huge inferno raging at the port, and the fuel was the wooden planks of these ships. And then he turned around to his troops, and you can imagine, like, these are troops that have just made a daring, perilous journey across to another continent. Not another country, another continent. This is uncharted territory. And he's sending an effective message. So he's telling them, there's no going back from here. He said, you have the Mediterranean behind you, and you have the enemy forces in front of you. You aren't going anywhere. So you can pull up your socks, you can tighten your waist belt, and we're going to march towards the enemy. And then he said, I will throw myself into the front lines as a private in my army. I'm not going to sit back in the HQ like a general, or I won't, like the opposition leader, King Roderick of the Visigoths. He was carried into the battle on his palanquin, which is sort of like a stretcher, and it was studded with jewels and diamonds and encrusted with all sorts of precious stones. And he wore his best clothes as if he was going to a gala or a ball, but he was at a battlefield. He was that confident that his troops would win. He was that confident. And Talik ibn Ziyad said, I will stand at the front, shoulder to shoulder, with everybody else. Don't assume that I will take a back seat, that I'll give myself all the luxury and comfort whilst throwing you into the jaws of death. So he burnt all of the ships to ashes. And then he went on his lightning fast campaigns. So within 6 months, this is unheard of, within 6 months, he'd defeated the main standing army of the Visigoths, and their numbers were three times the size of the Muslim army. So estimates put the Visigothic army at 3,000 to 4,000 with their heavy cavalry. Within 6 months, central authority had broken down. They'd taken the capital of Visigothic Spain, which was Toledo, and Talik ibn Ziyad had managed to assume control of almost half, more than half, of the entire peninsula in less than 6 months. In less than 6 months. And his famous battle, which he won, was a resounding victory for the Muslims. The battle of Wadi Lakka in Arabic, or the battle of the river of Babate, was actually fought during Ramadan. So you can add that to the roster of all these famous battles fought in Ramadan, like the Battle of Badr, Battle of Wadi Lakka now, the Battle of the Ain Jalut, where the Mongols were effectively stopped in their tracks, repulsed by the Mamluks. So you can add this to that shortlist as well. And he carried on. He swept across the Iberian Peninsula. And when he reached Toledo, then he sent a message to his commander, his superior officer in North Africa, Qaylawan, Musa ibn Nusayr. And he said, I've made headway into Andalusia, into the Iberian Peninsula. You can now bring the rest of the force. So Musa ibn Nusayr, with 12,000 soldiers, he made his way over to the Iberian Peninsula. And he was effectively the mop-up and consolidation crew. So with Talik ibn Ziyad's lightning-fast blitzkrieg, Musa ibn Nusayr was a little more deliberate. He was slower, he was calmer. And he consolidated land. He mopped up any last remnants of resistance. And then they both met in Toledo. Now, we don't have time to go into this, but what happened between Talik ibn Ziyad, Musa ibn Nusayr, and a third Arab lieutenant or officer in Talik's army, Mughith al-Rumi, what happened between this triangle, or the what I call the triumvirate, meaning the three really important figures of the early conquest, was nothing short of a soap opera or a drama. What happened between these three? It will give Coronation Street a run for its money. There was intrigue, there was a conspiracy. These guys were Muslims of the highest caliber, by the way. Musa ibn Nusayr was a tabi'i, so he was an epigon, somebody who had rubbed shoulders with the companions. And on a side note, there was actually, which just adds to the blessedness of the campaign of the conquest, the early conquest, there was one companion who actually accompanied Musa ibn Nusayr, one companion of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, one sahabi. His name was Munzir radiallahu anhu. So he was a junior companion at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, but nonetheless he accompanied Musa ibn Nusayr along with 20 high-ranking tabi'un, epigons. Musa ibn Nusayr was one of those. So they had a falling out, and Musa was he was actually infuriated. He was incensed with Talik ibn Ziyad because he told Talik, he gave him clear instructions, don't proceed any further. As soon as you've defeated the main army, then maintain your positions and don't move on. But Talik was, and this feeds into the lesson I want to give today. Talik was an energetic man. He was filled with vigor and he was very opportunistic. So he saw an opportunity. There was a chink in the armor of the Visigoths, and he thought to himself, if I listen to Musa ibn Nusayr and stay put, then the Visigoths will be able to reassemble their forces, remobilize, and it become even more difficult for us to take Spain. if I defy and disobey my superior commander, I'll have to face an earful when I meet him later on, but at least I can make gains for the army. And that's exactly what he did. So he took a risk, he took a gamble, and it paid off. And from Toledo, so he'd taken Toledo, and Toledo pretty much capitulated. They had surrendered. They weren't ready for a fight. Tariq was ready to advance even further, to push out even further. His troops were fatigued. Bear in mind, they'd been at this for 6 months on the trot, without any break. And according to some of the chronicles, there wasn't a single soldier in the army of Tariq ibn Ziyad who hadn't been injured. So all of them had battle scars and wounds. And he was there, girding himself. He was saddling up with his horse. And he was about to march out. And his troops turned to him and they said, "Have you lost your mind? We can't. It's physically impossible for us to march out any further." So Tariq was a compassionate leader. He turned around to his troops and he said, "Only because you've asked will I stay put. But if I could, in the name of Allah, and to do something called I'la'u kalimatillah, to exalt and glorify the name of Allah in all lands, I would carry on marching and I wouldn't stop. But just for you guys, to cut you guys some slack." So he stayed put. Musa caught up and they had a bit of a tiff. So Musa actually imprisoned Tariq and he charged him with contempt and insubordination, and he was actually about to execute him. Musa ibn Usayr was about to execute Tariq ibn Ziyad because he defied and disobeyed his orders. And this is where we now come to the human aspect of history. So we like to see history through these rose-tinted lenses, as if everybody before our age was a saint and everybody was punctual with their 5 daily prayers and they were all friends of Allah and they were all Muslims of the highest order, which isn't exactly true. The more you study history, the more sobering it becomes. Because what happens today is, I have noticed this amongst people who have some sort of nominal affinity and acquaintance with history. They succumb to the defeatist mentality of, the Muslims in the past were a million times better than us, so what can I possibly achieve? Read about the companions, read about Salah ad-Din, read about Yusuf ibn Tashfin, Tariq ibn Ziyad, and you feel dejected. You feel like, what can I accomplish compared to these people? So you'll sit back and you'll become fatalistic and you'll resign to just whatever the world's doing, or whatever whirlwind is destroying the world out there. Who cares? Let me just be swept away by this tidal wave. But in actual fact, they were human beings. So we've talked about how Tariq was a great man. We've lionized him. I mean, nobody would be able to. Thousands of miles away from your house. And imagine going for Hajj. Let me just try and give a parallel. You go for Hajj, and then in front of your family, your dependents, you just rip up your ticket. You rip up your ticket, you cancel your return flight, and you just say, "We're staying here now. We're staying here because we're going to worship Allah in His holy sanctuary, right in front of His house." I don't think anybody would be able to do that. Nobody would be able to do that. So this is effectively what he did. In front of an army, soldiers are always a little more undisciplined, a little more fractured, a little more unruly. But that shows the command that he had over his troops. That shows how they were awe-inspired by him. So we're painting the picture of a saint here and a hero. The same with Musa ibn Nusayr. He managed to achieve in North Africa what nobody else had managed to achieve, to integrate the Berbers. The Berbers were very difficult to get a hold of. But he managed to do that. He integrated them and he treated them like brothers. But Musa ibn Nusayr, a tabi'i, somebody who saw the companions of the highest caliber, was, to an extent, he was jealous. He was jealous of Tariq ibn Ziyad, because when you present yourself in front of the supreme commander, the caliph, the khalifa, then who's going to take the credit for this? So Musa ibn Nusayr was the commanding officer who presided over the entire campaign, but the troops know it was Tariq ibn Ziyad with his torrent of battles and the way he managed to completely shatter the Visigothic king and his own army. So everybody knows Tariq ibn Ziyad is the one who'll be wearing all the metaphoric medals in front of the caliph. So Musa didn't want that. Musa wanted him to wait so he can share some of the spoils, so he can add his name to the list of consummate commanders. And the prize jewel of any state is the capital. And the fact that Musa ibn Nusayr had to grapple with the idea and the reality that Tariq was a slave of Musa. Musa freed him and then trained him and drilled him in statecraft and warfare. in military ethics. So it probably rubbed salt into the wounds of Musa. He's the one. Now Musa, by the way, he didn't expect Tariq ibn Ziyad's initial expedition to be that successful. He thought he might win a couple of battles here and there, and he might be confined to the coastal regions. Maybe that's it. But he never, in a million years, neither did Tariq ibn Ziyad ever envisage marching all the way to Toledo, taking the capital, and then the treasures, the booty, the spoils of war that they amassed from the Andalusian campaign was unimaginable, unthinkable. All of these exotic jewels and diamonds and crowns that were studded with gold, there was a table called the Table of Solomon. It has nothing to do with Sulaiman alayhi salam, it was just a name given. The Table of Solomon, it was a high altar the priest used to use, and they would bring it out on days of festivity and celebrations, and they'd place the holy Christian scriptures, the gospels on them. It was made entirely out of gold. It was huge, pure solid gold. It was studded with diamonds and jewels, and the legs were made of silver. And that came into the possession of Tariq ibn Ziyad because he was a commanding officer. So Musa wasn't happy. Wasn't happy at all. So he was ready to execute his most trusted lieutenant, his right-hand man. Until Mughith al-Rumi intervened. He sent a letter to the Caliph, Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik, who was his childhood friend. And he said, you have to step in here and stop Musa ibn Nusayr from his madness. So messengers galloped back and forth and brought a letter, a decree from the Caliph saying, I intervene and I grant Tariq ibn Ziyad amnesty. So release him immediately. And he did. But then Musa called Tariq over. He was still a bit bitter and sore. So he said to Tariq, I want you to give me whatever spoils of war you've amassed from the campaign, bring it to me. Because I want to be the one who has the sole honor and privilege of presenting it to the Caliph. So Tariq said, fair enough. Now Tariq's men were all on his side because Tariq was admired and adored by all of his troops. So when presenting the Table of Solomon, Tariq quite cheekily snapped off a table leg and kept it with him. Kept it with him. And when he presented the table, he said, this is it. Musa said, why is there a leg missing? Tariq said, just shrugged his shoulders, I don't know. Maybe in the fighting it must have been broken off. Musa said, fair enough. So the campaign carried on, right? That wasn't the purpose of the story. The campaign carried on. And within three years, up until 714, Musa ibn Nusayr had marched to southern France and he had captured the capital of what's known as Septimania. Septimania, during the Roman era, was a cluster of seven cities. And he captured the main provincial capital of Narbonne. Within 3 years, lightning fast. So, lesson number one here. And then we'll quickly get onto the fate of Tariq, Mughith al-Rumi and Musa, because it's quite interesting. Lesson number one here. In this story, which is true by the way, you have two leadership, critical leadership styles which have been represented in the people of Musa and Tariq. Musa represents consolidation, and Tariq represents initiation. So within any organization, within a society, within any institute, you need somebody who has that winning mindset. Somebody who's always looking on the horizon for another challenge. Somebody who has this indomitable spirit that can never yield to anything. He's just plowing forward, ahead, ahead, ahead. All he sees is forwards. He doesn't have blinders on. He doesn't have... Nothing will distract him. So he'll see the end goal and he'll push forward. No matter the resources, no matter the consequences, no matter the capital that needs to be invested. These people are actionable, they're energetic, and they have this creative spark of tenacity within them. So they're like a runaway train. It can't be derailed. That was Tariq ibn Ziyad. He had to face the flak for that from his superior commander Musa, but Allah made a way out for him. Because he did what was right. Then you have Tariq, then you have Musa, the consolidator. So Tariq is a trailblazer, and he's left a path of fire and destruction, metaphorically speaking, in front of him. So Musa was the one who came behind, sweeping, consolidating, pacifying. So any little bits of land that needed to be subjugated, Musa was there. As Musa went from town to town, in the wake of Tariq's campaign, Musa set up civil administration. Musa made sure that garrisons were deployed in each town. Musa made sure stability and security and safety were the norm of the day in all of these towns. So you can sum that up with a very simple analogy. In any organization, you need to have somebody who's looking forward and somebody who's looking down. The people that are looking down, they need to be the ones who are making sure we aren't stumbling, we aren't tripping, there are no obstacles in the path. And the people that are looking ahead are the ones who are strategizing. They're the ones who are planning. They have a roadmap for the future. So this is a symbiotic relationship. Without Tariq, Musa wouldn't have been able to do his job. And without Musa, Tariq's gains would have been lost as quick as they'd been gained. So both of these demographics and groups are important. In any institution, more importantly, in a society. For example, within the family structure, the father represents the initiator and the mother represents the consolidator. With our traditional gender roles, the mother will stay at home and ensure the children are keeping up to date with homework, making sure the house is tidy, clean, food, all the normal chores that we've done at home. Not to trivialize what she's doing, that's her pathway to paradise. The father, at the same time, he needs to be working. He needs to make sure food's on the table. He needs to make sure the bills are paid. He needs to make sure car insurance is taken care of. He needs to make sure the path for the future, right, is there. He's forging a path. Within an institution, and I've seen this firsthand, and it's something we need to work on as mosque organizations. I was an imam at a mosque in Preston for a year, so I managed to see the pros and cons of most things. So in most mosques, imams like your Mufti Abdullah and Mufti Saleh only represent the, you could say, the initiators. Or a little bit of both, actually. A little bit of both. Maybe I'd say maybe the consolidators, right? So I call this firefighting imamate. Firefighting, there are fires constantly appearing in every different area, and the imam's job is to, quite literally, without any disrespect, like a headless chicken, run from one place to another, cover this job and meet this person and answer his question and sort out this marital problem and arbitration and so many things to do. So he's the one who's looking down, making sure you're not stumbling and society isn't tripping. So he's doing the consolidating. As for initiating, he needs a team. He needs people that can allow him to get on with his job whilst they're providing you ideas. Whilst they're always constantly ensuring that there's a conveyor belt of creativity that the imam can then sprinkle his special dust on and then the society can just get on with it. But for the most part, imams are bogged down with tasks that are menial, I would say. Menial. The imam should be leading the society as the initiator. The imam should be the initiator and everybody else should be consolidating. So the imam needs a team of volunteers. And I think this mosque is, to an extent, trailblazing, because I've been liaising with Mufti Yusuf Sab to organize this. So that's one less burden on Mufti Abdullah. So at least he knows there's a team of people who've initiated and I can consolidate. How is Mufti Abdullah consolidating? He'll introduce, he'll tell people, he'll make the announcement, he'll hand it over to me, and then he'll move on. So he'll be the pretty face, the poster boy of everything. But then he'll be there doing everything. But he needs a team. So he needs his Tariq ibn Ziyad. It can work either way. The imam can be Musa ibn Nusayr with a group of Tariqs, or the imam can be Tariqs with a group of Musa ibn Nusayrs. Now that's where you guys step in. So I remember when I was at Masjid Salam in Fullwood, the brilliant thing was that community had a high population of professionals. It had a professional demographic. So IT technicians and medical professionals and lawyers and people who were professional youth coaches. These are like professional volunteers. So I would be creating the schemes, I would be initiating, I would be consolidating as well, but I had a team of volunteers that could help me out. So your job is to find your niche. It can be something very, very simple. How can I contribute? How can I volunteer my expertise? I'll give you an example. There used to be, well, there still is, a Scouts Association in Preston, 10th Fullwood Scouts, the first Muslim Scouts Association in Preston. And you have hundreds of children that are part of the organization, and each week they have sessions, and in each session they work towards a badge. So the next badge that they were working on, I'm talking about 3 or 4 years ago, was the circuits badge. So they had to create an electric circuit. Very simple, with the conduits and the batteries and then the light bulb. Very simple. So before that, the lead of the entire association is Mullah Amjad Bapu. So Mullah Amjad was approached by an electrician. And the electrician said, I want to volunteer myself for the mosque and I want to serve the community, but I just don't know how. So can you provide me an avenue? Can you channel me in the right direction? So Mullah Amjad said, you're the best man for the job. This week, we're working on the circuits badge. And who better to lead the circuit session than an electrician? So here you are. He was called into the mosque, and not in the mosque, to the Scouts Association building, and he delivered the session. And everybody liked it because there was a new face here and a subject-specific expert. So that's just one example. But you have to find out where you can help out around the mosque. You need to approach Mufti Abdullah, and the committee, the management, Mufti Yusuf, and say, look, this is what I'm good at. Use me. Either make me an initiator or make me a consolidator. Now the thing is, very rarely will you ever find a leader who amalgamates both of these qualities. You rarely find a leader who is an initiator and a consolidator. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was one. An initiator and a consolidator. So we need teams of people. So this is lesson number one. Islamic Spain teaches us. Initiators and consolidators. Are you a tariq? Are you somebody who just has this burning energy? And I know there are some people, I think I'm a little bit like this, where I just like to constantly be finding new horizons and new challenges. But I don't like sitting back and sorting out all the paperwork and the documents and all the boring stuff. Musa represents the guy who does the boring stuff at the office desk. But you need somebody like that. Somebody behind the scenes who's beavering away to make sure that the initiators can just plow ahead. And then there are some people who don't mind sitting there and doing the tax returns or filling out the documents or making sure the bills are paid for the mosque. So the committee members would be your consolidators. And the imams and everybody else would be your initiators. Now you just have to find out, will I help with the consolidating or with the initiating? That's number one. Just to quickly tell you about the fate, quite tragic fate of Musa al-Tariq and Mughith al-Rumi. Caliph al-Walid ibn Abd al-Malik, 714, said, and this is the reason why he called back. He halted Tariq ibn Ziyad, Musa, and Mughith al-Rumi's expedition. And he said, look, just put a stop to it. And I want all of you guys to come back in a massive, splendid procession. And you can bring all of the captives and the booty, the spoils of war back within your retinue. And we'll have a caliphal procession in Damascus. The real reason why he called everyone back was because he heard some harebrained, some absolutely mad ideas coming out of Tariq ibn Ziyad and Musa's camp. So some of the soldiers in Musa's army got word back to the caliph, Al-Walid, saying, I don't know what's overtaken or possessed Musa, but we're not sure whether he's serious or whether he's just pulling our leg. But he's broached the subject with a couple of his troops that he wants to, this is his end game, he wants to make his way from Muslim Spain to Damascus. Not from the previously trodden route of North Africa, but through Europe. So he wants to cross around Europe, go through uncharted territory, defeat all the Germanic tribes in his path. So we're talking about making his way through France, through Switzerland, through Italy, and then having a bit of a pit stop. This is how he described it, a pit stop at Constantinople, besiege Constantinople, take Constantinople as if it's just a side quest or a secondary mission which can just be done in a couple of hours and then circle back round to Damascus. Hair-brained, absolutely ridiculous idea for some of the troops, but Musa was dead serious. So Al-Walid couldn't risk such an expedition because if it could fail, then it would fail and it would backfire spectacularly. So to avoid any experimentation with his troops, and with his caliphal image, he said, let's call everybody back. Along the way, do you know what happened? Between these three, the triumvirate, bickering. They quibbled and they just argued along the entire way. Because there was a Visigothic count who'd been taken captive. And the Visigothic count is a high value prisoner. So the question came up, who's going to present the prisoner to the Caliph, Al-Walid? So Tariq said, I should. Mughith al-Rumi said, I should. Musa said, I should, because I'm the commanding officer. And they turned around, both of them ganged up on Musa and said, well, you didn't capture him. You didn't enslave him. So why should you take all the glory and honor? So do you know what Musa did? He said, if I can't have him, nobody can. So we executed the captive. He executed the count, one of the Visigothic counts. So Tariq and Al-Mughith al-Rumi were infuriated. So they galloped ahead to Al-Walid and they told him everything. It's like going to the head teacher before your friend gets there and telling off my friend, well, he did this and he did that and this is what I was meant to do. And they divulged everything. But Al-Walid was a good friend of Musa. Al-Walid knew how excellent Musa was. He was an asset. So he didn't give Musa too much grief about it. The problem Musa had was Al-Walid was about to die. He was on his deathbed. The caliph who was next in line, Suleiman, sent an emissary to Musa whilst he was still traveling to Damascus and said, I don't want you to reach Damascus until I'm enthroned, because I want the sole glory and honor of receiving the spoils from this exotic land of milk and honey, Andalusia, Muslim Spain. I don't want my brother Al-Walid to have that privilege. So now Musa, he's facing a conundrum here. Al-Walid is his good friend. So does he betray his friendship for Suleiman, or does he risk bearing the brunt of Suleiman's vindictive attitude? And Suleiman was a caliph. He only ruled for about 2 or 3 years. Suleiman was a caliph who was on a warpath against anybody whom he disliked. Anybody who might have done anything to anger him or upset him, then he would make his life a living hell. So those were the consequences. Those were the outcomes Musa was faced with. Musa chose the former. He thought, you know what? I'm ready to face whatever Suleiman throws at me. Let's make it to Al-Walid. And he did make it to Al-Walid. Walid was in semi-good health. And then he died shortly after. Suleiman ascended the throne. Suleiman said, all the spoils that you've brought from Andalusia, present it before me. In Islamic law, 1/5 of the spoils are to be designated for the supreme commander, the caliph in this instance. So Musa presented the Table of Solomon. What was wrong with the Table of Solomon? Missing a leg. So he asked Musa, what happened to the leg? He said, well, we just never had it when it came into our possession. Tariq sneakily had snuck the leg that he kept with him into Musa's baggage. Reminiscent of Yusuf alayhi salam's story with him and Bin Yamin. And then the caliph's guards searched Musa and pulled out, lo and behold, it was the missing leg of the Table of Solomon. So Musa said, how dare you? Suleiman said to Musa, how dare you? How dare you try to deceive me, the caliph? How dare you try to withhold anything which is rightfully my property? So Musa was stripped of all of his titles. He was demoted. He was dishonorably discharged. Not honorably, dishonorably discharged. He was about to be executed as well, when somebody else, Yazid ibn al-Muhallab, one of Musa's friends, interceded for him and said, you know what, just cut him some slack. Keep him in my house as house arrest. Suleiman said, fair enough. He levied an exorbitant fee and penalty on Musa, millions of gold coins. He can't pay that off. Millions of gold coins. And Musa was reduced in one night from the decorated commander of the greatest conquest ever undertaken by Muslims within the first century to a pauper, to a nobody. Tariq ibn Ziyad, he also faced the wrath of Suleiman. He was demoted, he was stripped of all of his medals and accolades, and he was just shipped back off to Andalusia, and he died in obscurity. Only Mughith came away with a little bit of his reputation intact because he played the game. He knew to play the game. And if that wasn't enough, this is Suleiman's vindictive nature. Because Musa had, in his eyes, deceived him or outwitted him, Suleiman couldn't rest until he'd itched, until he'd managed to satisfy a deeply seated itch within his own soul, which was, I can't exact true revenge until anybody associated with Musa ibn Nusayr faces their demise or ruination come to them. So when Musa left Andalusia, then he had appointed his son Abdul Aziz as the governor. So Sulaiman ibn Abdul Malik, the caliph, had sent his assassins to assassinate Musa's son in North Africa. He was taken out of the equation simply because he was associated with Musa, nothing else, through no fault of his own. And with Abdul Aziz in Andalusia, he initiated a smear campaign. Lies and propaganda, disinformation were disseminated against Abdul Aziz, and eventually he was assassinated by a hit squad that was sent by Sulaiman. To rub salt in the wounds, as if that wasn't enough, as if the poor Musa, who's approaching his 80s here, as if that wasn't enough, heartbreak, to have been reduced to nothing, Sulaiman had the assassins decapitate his son Abdul Aziz, who was one of the best governors in his short reign, one of the best governors of Andalusia, had Abdul Aziz's body decapitated, head was severed, embalmed, and placed in a chest, and then transported to the caliphal court in Damascus. And then in the court, he called Musa ibn Usayr, and he said, satirically, here's a present for you. Didn't tell him what was in there. Musa opened the chest, and he found the head of his son in there. And Musa was lost for words. And shortly after that, he died of grief. So, this was Sulaiman. Sulaiman did try to make amends for his life of wretchedness. How? He bucked the trend at the end of his life. In 719, he was about to die. He had no heirs who were of age. And in the line of succession, his father had stipulated his brother, Yazid ibn Abd al-Malik, to be the next caliph. And Yazid wasn't that much better anyway. So, he made a radical departure from the policy of succession, and he appointed Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, the pious caliph, Umar radiallahu anhu's great grandson. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz was an Umayyad from his father's side, and he was from Umar's lineage from his mother's side. And he tried to make amends for his mistakes. So that was number one, initiation versus consolidation. We've got a couple more here, a couple more lessons that I'll get through within the next 25 minutes. So, let's just quickly put Andalusia on hold for a second and jump back to the east, the Umayyads in the east. So how did the Umayyads in the east meet their demise? Why did the state collapse? So this was a curious question that was posed to ex-Umayyad tax collectors and auditors and officers who had been integrated into the new Abbasid Empire. So they were asked, what happened to the Umayyads? They ruled the world. 11 million kilometers squared worth of land was under their control. What happened to them? Why did they face their demise? So this was the answer that they gave, and I've translated it, and I'll read it out to you here. Paragraph number one, they said, this was the answer. Very uncomplicated, very candid, transparent answer. They didn't beat around the bush. They said the political elite deserted their administrative and civic duties. Why? In a frenzy of vanity, luxury, and opulence. So they saw the gold glittering in their eyes and they left all of their duties. Wealth, it always boils down to wealth. Two things. The fall of a civilization will always boil down to two things. Wealth or social recognition. Wealth or fame. That's it. You bring me any other civilization which fell because of another reason and you can sit in my place here. Two reasons. There might be a long-winded explanation, but you follow the money trail, follow the paper trail, and it'll take you back to wealth or fame. That's it. And then they said, carried on, we violated the rights of our subjects. The Prophet ﷺ said very clearly, كُلُّكُمْ مَسْؤُولٌ عَنْ رَعِيَّتِهِ. You're all shepherds, you have a flock, look after them. If not, you'll be held accountable. To the point where they became despondent of any justice. They felt like we can't trust our leaders to be just with us, or to be fair. They hoped for respite from the state, our subjects. But instead, they were imposed with heavy taxes, which they could not bear. Then they carried on by saying, our losses on the military front began to compound. The state treasury ran dry, and we invested unhealthy amounts of authority into ministers who prioritized feathering their nests, meaning gathering money, above the ambitions of the government. So people who are in positions of authority, but all they can care about is money, money, money. Lining my pockets with as much gold and as much wealth as possible. And then these are some important administrative points. They carried on by saying, our soldiers received belated salaries. So we paid them late. What did the Prophet say about that? The Prophet said, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, you should pay your employee before the sweat drop dries from his forehead. Have a look at this. All the reasons they're giving, you can source the origins of their demise from prophecies of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He's telling us, our soldiers received belated salaries, giving rise to malcontents, people who weren't happy among their ranks. And now, having no reason to remain loyal to the Umayyad cause, they mobilized against us at the beck and call of our enemies. You see why it's important to make sure you pay your employees on time? So they remain loyal to you, so they do a good job for you. The Prophet didn't just say these things arbitrarily, there's always a reason. This is the reason. Their own troops in Khurasan turned against them. 50,000 troops that the Umayyads had deposited there in Khurasan, which is modern-day Afghanistan, at the start of the Umayyad Empire, turned on them at the end because they realized we're being discriminated against. When we set our opponents in our own crosshairs, we were administered with a bitter dose of reality. We had no true allies and we stood not a single chance against them. But most of all, the emergence of subversive movements, underground movements that sought to undermine our authority, and the increasing privatization and secrecy of our affairs, meaning they started to do things in the shadows, backroom deals and underhand affairs, became the bane of our existence and the trigger of our downfall. You see, all of those things came from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Something as small as not paying your employees on time became the downfall of a state. Now we zip back to North Africa and Andalusia. There is an author, we've got around 15 to 20 minutes. There is an author who is a non-Muslim. And funnily enough, this non-Muslim author was actually part of a neo-Nazi fascist movement, political movement, before the launch of World War II. So he's Catholic, neo-Nazi fascist. But he wrote a book on Muslim Spain, which is quite good, by the way. Put his credentials aside, the book's quite good. Non-Muslim, by the way, and this is what he said. This is the reason why the Umayyad Emirate in Cordoba fell. Only a couple of lines. He said, political unity is hard to achieve when religious inspiration weakens and men are unwilling to rise above mere human nature. Unity flows from spiritual authority alone. End quote. From a non-Muslim. So you can't expect to rule the world. You can't expect to piece together your fractured and dented prestige as a community. You can't sit there singing the praises and eulogy of Salahuddin. When's the next Salahuddin going to grace us? When will Palestine be liberated? When will these petty Arab states, the nation states, coalesce and join forces and manage to defeat the state of Israel? When would that ever happen? Well, you can't aspire for political unity until you have religious unity. What does religious unity mean? We talk about the word Tawheed, right? But it's a shame because when we talk about Tawheed, we only talk about it in the context of doctrine or theology. So Tawheed just means oneness of Allah, monotheism, as opposed to, for example, Trinity, 3 equals 1, 1 equals 3. Or polytheism, like Hinduism, millions of gods. But Tawheed is actually a way of life. Tawheed is a way of life. Tawheed, when we say unity, we mean you need to have a unity of purpose, a unified vision, wherein your vision is dominated by Tawheed, by Allah, by Islam, by the Sunnah. So everything you do has to be permeated with the Sunnah, with Allah, with the Prophet's lifestyle. So you're inside the mosque here, Tawheed. Allah is at the forefront. What does Allah want me to do? What does Allah not want me to do? How can I gain proximity to Allah? How can I please Allah? How can I avoid anything which would infuriate Allah? Not just here, but in every sphere and facet of life. So employment, occupation, at home, family, using social media, when you're with your friends, other socializing networks, this is what you call Tawheed. Unity. So bring all of the different aspects of your life onto Islam. Gather it all and unify it onto this main vision of Islam. That's what Tawheed means. Not just, I believe in one Allah, tick box exercise, that's it. I can tick it off the list. I am now a Muslim. Tawheed's done and dusted. Tawheed is not complete until everything you do revolves around Tawheed. Until all roads lead back to Allah. Because this train of Islam, this is the analogy that I'll give. Islam is like a train. It's currently docked at the platform. And it's about to leave in a few minutes. The train will depart, whether you're on it or not. And the train will reach its final destination, whether it's going to be after a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. Does it make a difference? The train will reach the platform at the other train station. Your job is to make sure that you are on board that train when it reaches its destination. Islam will ultimately prevail. Allah promised his companions, Allah promised the prophets, كَتَبَ اللَّهُ لَأَغْلِبَنَّ أَنَا وَرُسُلِي. Me and my companions and my prophets and their partisans and their followers and their supporters will be victorious. Will be victorious. Allah hasn't put a time frame on that. It could be today, it could be tomorrow, it could be next year. Your job is just to make sure you're on board that train before the doors close. Because everybody else on board will reach a destination and they'll be met with a standing ovation and a guard of honor when they disembark, and you'll be left there on the other platform moping and wallowing in self-pity. Why did I not board that train? When will that day be? The hereafter. It'll be in the hereafter or it'll be in this world. It'll be in the hereafter or it'll be in this world. In the hereafter, you'll be there. Everybody else who raced ahead, the initiators, the consolidators, they'll be there and they'll be enjoying themselves in paradise. And you'll be lagging behind because you lag behind in this world. Or when we march into Palestine, eventually when it will be free, we ask Allah it happen during our lifetime, then you won't be at the front lines. Or you won't get the same amount of reward. So you have to be on the right side of history. Allah says in the Quran, لا يستوي منكم من أنفق من قبل الفتح وقاتل. Before the conquest of Mecca, those people who were the trailblazers, the pioneers who sacrificed everything, the amount of money that they gave and donated, the blood that they shed, their own blood that they spilt, everything they had to give up and put to one side, their reward can never be equal to anybody who does exactly the same or even more after the conquest of Mecca. Because it's easy now. Mecca's there. It's in your hands. So it's easy for you to say, I'm going to give some money. Or I'm going to sacrifice. I'm going to donate. Because it's trendy now. It's fashionable. Because you have civilizational authority. But before, when you only had a couple of pounds or a couple of gold coins, when the companions had nothing and they were still giving, that's what truly counts. So now when it's difficult to be a pro-Palestinian activist, when the authorities are cracking down, where you can hold up a placard which has a coconut and you'll be prosecuted for that, when anything you say could be censored, where your job could be at risk, now is a time where that reward will truly be accrued. And to our dismay, non-Muslims have surpassed us. Just a couple of weeks ago, there were around 26 employees from Google. And if anybody knows here how competitive and cutthroat the tech environment is in the Silicon Valley in America, you'll know. To gain a Google internship, you could spend your entire life doing that. And these people had already achieved that, Google employees, and they orchestrated a stage sit-in, a protest within the Google headquarters. They were all summarily fired. There and then, pro-Palestine. Just because of that. So they don't care about wealth, they don't care about prestige, they don't care about position. They gave it all up for the cause. And isn't that what we learn here? From the story of the downfall of the Umayyads. Wealth is ephemeral. Position, authority, fame is temporal. We'll only be here for a couple of years. What will truly last will be the legacy that you leave. So these people might have been kicked out from Google, but the whole world applauded them because they prioritized ethics and Palestine over their paychecks. So it's about prioritizing in your brain. What comes first for me? So the author's name was Angus McNab. So political unity can only come with religious unity. Religious unity meaning we're all on the same wavelength. We're all coming to the mosque. We're all making sure we're praying. We're all making sure we're giving money in charity. We're all making sure we're cutting down on bad deeds. We're all making sure we're evicting these misdemeanors from our lives that cause all the problems that we have. So that's how we can start this. Okay, so we've got around 15 minutes left. I think I'm going to use this to segue into 2 points here. Number one is, if you can remember, we talked about these petty states. So after the Umayyad authority fell, then you had 25 different states. Everybody was rushing to grab their own piece of territory, to have their own slice of the cake. And these rulers, they might have been excellent warriors and ingenious poets, but they were people who had a faulty moral compass. Let's put it like that. So out of all of these states, by the year 1040, these 25 had been whittled down to 6. You had the statelet of Seville, or Sevilla, the statelet of Badajoz, which is in the northwest, the statelet of Cordoba, the statelet of Valencia, the statelet of Toledo, and the statelet of Zaragoza, these 6. Out of all of them, the most powerful were the Abbadids. Not the Abbasids, the Abbadids, Banu Abbad of Seville. Out of all of those, the Abbadids were at the top of the food chain. They were the apex predators. And Al-Mu'tamid was the king and ruler of Seville at that time. So number one is, the terrain then is very reminiscent of the modern Middle East. Think about it. You've got lots of different states. Even though it's mind-boggling, they're all Muslims. They all have this unifying factor of being Arab. But still, there's a problem between them. Still, you have Algeria and Morocco that have border tiffs. There were a couple of holidaymakers, and they a few months ago, they unwittingly, accidentally, they wandered into, I think it was Algerian waters. And the Coast Guard shut them down and killed them. I can't remember if it was Algeria or Morocco, but something happened. All because of land, all because of borders that were drawn by the white man. All because of borders that were drawn by Europeans to keep you disunited and fragmented. And it worked, because if you're not one whole unit, then you're easier to break down. They want to segmentize everybody so they can deal with everybody. If we pool our resources and strengths together, then it becomes more difficult for us to be exploited or taken advantage of. So the Christians, northern Christians, made the most amount of headway during this period. And it's not a surprise. When the Muslims were fragmented, then in the year 1085, King Alfonso VI took Toledo without much of a fight. And that would have signaled the end of Andalusia. So Andalusia's lifespan could have been cut off in the year 1085, because he had previously reached Tarifa, which is in southern Spain. So he'd cut through the entirety of Andalusia, just brushed aside all of these statelets and petty kings, and marched to the south. And he was on the Mediterranean coast, and he proclaimed himself the Empire of Spain. And to make it even more difficult for the Muslim to swallow, he said, "I am the emperor of the three faiths, of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity." As if, you guys are still around, but sovereignty really lies with me. And by the way, Tarifa, the name Tarifa, is actually the name of one of Musa ibn Nusayr's earlier lieutenants and scouts. So before he sent Tariq ibn Ziyad, he wanted to test out whether the experiment of sending troops into Andalusia wouldn't be a suicide mission, or would it be a lucrative endeavor. So he sent Tarif Abu Zar'a, who was a Berber, with around 400 soldiers, and they landed at a place which was given his name, Tarifa. So Muslim legacy there is strong. So anyway, this is to highlight the depravity of these ta'ifas, of these statelets. You're thinking to yourself, well, no, why don't the governments of Muslim states around the world do something? The problem is, they're absorbed. They've been consumed by, putting it very simply, wealth and self-preservation. The idea of the larger ummah, And Allah, the body politic of Muslims, doesn't exist. The same with these rulers, the Ta'ifa rulers. 1,000 years, by the way, 1,000 years. So what we're facing today is nothing new, it's nothing novel. So we had a solution, we had a fix for what happened then. We also have a, it might not be a cure-all, but it's a pill that can lead us in the right direction. But just to give you an example, so Al-Mu'tamid was the leader, and he was classed as the strongest and the most capable out of all the Ta'ifa kings. But in the face of Alfonso the Sixth, the king of Leon and Castile, he was a minnow. He was a nobody. And at the negotiating table, these kings would enlist the help of the Christians to attack neighboring Muslims. But at the same time, they'd have to pay something called pariahs. In Spanish, it's a tribute that you pay to the Christian king to keep him happy, to placate him, to mollify him so he doesn't attack your territory. But what would happen in the end anyway was I'd call a Christian king to attack my fellow Muslim neighbor, and the Christian king, who's arguably more militarily capable than I am, would take over the enemy, take his state, and then take mine anyway. So you'd lose out. You compromise on your faith, you lose out in every scenario, in this world and in the hereafter. And this can be represented in a poem by Sheikh Zahir al-Kawthari. He used to say, تَمَزَّقْتُ أَوْ تَمَزَّقْنَا تَمَزَّقْنَا دُنْيَانَا تَمَزَّقْنَا دِينَنَا بِتَلْقِيعِ دِينِنَا بِتَلْقِيعِ دُنْيَانَا وَلَا دِينُنَا يَبْقَى وَلَا دُنْيَانَا. So we would tear apart our garments of the hereafter, the silk brocade garments of the hereafter, so that we can patch up the garments we're wearing in the world. And then at the end of it, we'd ruined our garments in the hereafter. They were in tatters, rips and tears and all sorts of filth everywhere. And then in this world, when I try to present this garment to somebody else, it'll just look like a patchwork of rubbish. And they'll think, what on earth even is this? But I'll have lost out, because I'll have lost the validation of people in this world. And when I go to Allah in the hereafter, I won't have a full garment to wear because I ripped it up to patch up the one in this world. So you've lost that in every scenario. You compromise and you lose. So this is what happened. And he now was at the negotiation table with Alfonso. And Alfonso said, look, if you want to parlay and negotiate, then you have to submit to my terms. And one of the terms was Al-Mu'tamid had to hand over his ravishing and beautiful daughter, Zaida, to Alfonso as a pledge that he wouldn't renege on his promise, along with a multitude of other fortresses and villages, as dowry. As dowry. So this man had no moral compunctions giving over his daughter, a Muslim daughter, or in some sources it was his daughter-in-law, either way, still diabolical, to a Christian king in marriage, which is, that's not even a valid Islamic marriage. Just to preserve his own state. Just to preserve his own state. And if things weren't already bad, then the princess Zaida formed a deep admiration for the king, the warrior she was betrothed to. And outrageously and tragically, because of what her father had done, she ended up apostatizing. So she became a Christian. And she was baptized as Maria Isabel. And she married King Alfonso and bore him his only son, Sancho. And she died before her husband. So this is the level of, this is just one example out of an ocean of how depraved these people actually were. So what was the fix? And I'll finish on this. I'll close this so you know that I'm finishing. What was the fix? What was the solution? What was the cure-all for these Muslims? After the siege of Toledo, this was, and again, this is all part of Allah's master plan. Sometimes we become so heedless and negligent, and we become so engrossed by the world around us, Allah just sends a message our way that jolts us out of our slumber, that awakens us from our intoxication. It might be painful, it might be miserable, and it might be difficult to endure, but that's what a rude awakening is. Sometimes something bad needs to happen for something good to happen after that. Sometimes you need to take one step back to be able to propel yourself forward. Think about Olympic runners. What do? They take a step back and then they can push forward. Now somebody, nobody will ever say, well, why would you take one step back on a racetrack? Surely you want to take one step forward, but they know. A couple steps back, consolidate, then you can initiate and push forward. So the taking of Toledo, and the fall of Toledo, was a seismic event. And it forced these petty kings to swallow their pride, swallow their ambitions of self-preservation, and turn to North Africa. Because from North Africa, there emerged a group of doctrinaires, really principled, austere, rugged, as tough as nails warriors, known as the Murabitun, or the Almoravids. They were led by Yusuf ibn Tashfin. Yusuf ibn Tashfin was around 80 years old, just under 80 years old, around 79 years old at this point in time. And his entire movement, he'd taken the northwestern strip of Africa from Morocco all the way up until Ghana in the south. And he did not have his eyes set on Andalusia. He was worried about spreading Islam and Islamizing the tribes, the Berber tribes in North Africa that had nominally accepted Islam. So his movement had a military component to it, but primarily it was one of da'wah, outreach and missionary work. And he made a name for himself as a religious man. Very principled. There are a couple of poems that I'd gathered from people that had eulogized him, but we don't have the time for that. But he was a man who commanded respect, even though he was, in the eyes of the Andalusians, he was a backwards, unsophisticated, uncivilized camel herder. What happened over time, another lesson we can't get into. Over time, the Andalusians became enamored by their own civilizational prowess. So they thought to themselves, we're at the top of the world. And that forced a superiority complex on them. And because of that superiority complex, the lay people, the Andalusians, the Muslims, not the mercenaries from North Africa, the Andalusians forgot what it meant to sacrifice, forgot what it meant to give up, forgot what it meant to live a life where you are accustomed to difficulty and hardship. And because of that, the Andalusian masses had lost the spirit of jihad. So that meant now they were reliant on external forces to carry out jihad for them, because they'd been mollified and mollycoddled by years of luxury and opulence. So there was a summit after the fall of Toledo, and all of these narcissistic and self-absorbed Ta'ifa kings came to the table and they said, what on earth do we do now? What do we do now? And Al-Mu'tamid, again, the man who gave his own daughter or daughter-in-law, still a man drenched in turpitude and evil, but he was a man who still was allied to Islam. So he said, you can imagine, he breathed a very heavy sigh, and he said to his fellow comrades, because he was, out of all the Ta'ifa kings, he was seen as their leader, unofficial leader. And he said, we're going to have to call Yusuf ibn Tashfin. We're going to have to enlist the help of the Almoravids. We can't win this battle alone. We're too disunited and too fragmented to do that by ourselves. So there was a clamor in the room and everybody started objecting, because they said what will eventually happen is, which is what eventually did happen, Yusuf ibn Tashfin will come here with the objective of pushing back and repulsing the Christians from the north, but he'll eventually take over Andalusia. We know it's bound to happen. We know it's bound to happen as the cycle of civilization goes. People who have stooped to new lows will always be replaced by a group of people with vigor and energy, as Ibn Khaldun's theory goes. So Al-Mu'tamid said, you know what? I would rather be, these are his own words to his son, I would rather be a camel herder, a camelier, than a swine herder. I would rather live under subjugation, live a life of servitude to Muslims from North Africa, and roll back the years, literally go back to the Stone Ages and live as a camel herder. This is a man who lived in luxury, far beyond our comprehension. If you go to Seville today, have a look at the palaces and the orchards and the gardens, and that's a fraction of what those people lived in, what Al-Mu'tamid had at his disposal. He was ready to give it all up. This is a man who gave his own daughter. That's why I wanted to contrast these ideas. He was willing to do that, but at the same time, he still recognized, I am willing to go back and live a primitive life in the Stone Ages if it means Islam gains ascendancy, rather than living in opulence, but as a swineherd, under the subjugation of Christian forces or non-Muslims. So for us today, you are going, if you want to relive the glory of Muslim Spain or any other epoch of history, we need to convince ourselves we would rather be camel herders than swine herders. We have to tell ourselves that. We have to give up. We have to sacrifice. We have to shed the extra baggage and the dead weight before we can take steps forward. Before we can piece together our shattered civilizational glory. And Al-Mu'tamid realized that. Al-Mu'tamid realized that. He was willing to give up his own daughter. He did give up his own daughter, who apostatized. But he still realized Yusuf ibn Tashfin is the only person that can help us. And all credit to Yusuf. He told, and he specifically added this as a clause. He said, well, he agreed to the clause stipulated by the Taifa kings. He said, look, I'm not here for booty. I'm not here for wealth. I'm not here for recognition. I'm making the perilous journey all the way to Andalusia, crossing the Strait of Gibraltar with my own troops. The Mulathamun, they were called, the ones who were veiled. They had blue face guards on. So they wrapped a blue cloth around their face. You could only see their eyes. So very menacing. Very simplistically dressed. And the Andalusians, when they saw detachments and battalions of these Mulathamun, the Almoravid troops, and their vanguard marching past, and they held them with contempt. Who are these backwards immigrants who've come in, uncivilized, uncouth, they don't dress like us, they don't talk like us, they don't have the same refined character as us. They look down upon them. But these Almoravids and Almurabitun crushingly defeated King Alfonso VI in the Battle of Zallaqa. And that gave Muslim Spain a lifeline. And true to his promise, Yusuf ibn Tashfin said, I've done my job of helping Muslims and defeating the enemy and going back to North Africa now. You do what you like. He didn't take advantage of anything. This man was purely devoted to Islam. We talk about sincerity, right? What the sixth point, al-ikhlas, in the sixth point. People normally fall asleep because it might be a little bit cliche. But these are, for an example, these are stories you can use to enrich, right? The way we talk about certain, or maybe platitudes or points that have become very simplistic, but this is a real life example of somebody being sincere to the highest degree. He could have taken over Andalusia, but he didn't. He had the manpower. He had the fuqaha, he had the jurists on his side. The jurists pled with him. The religious scholars of Andalusia pleaded at his feet, and they said, please, we need you to just take over. These people aren't worthy of ruling. Yusuf said, no, I've made an agreement. I'm here to just do i'la kalimatillah, exalt the word of Allah. And he went back. He was called again. He was called again for a second time. And he went back. He was called again for a third time. And during the third battle, the third time he was called in 1090, the Taifa kings started bickering with each other on the battlefield. You take the right flank. No, I want to take the right flank. And you take the left flank. I don't want to be the rear guard. I want to be the vanguard. And they just bickered. And they lost the battle. So Yusuf had enough. He went back to Imam. He sent a messenger to Imam al-Ghazali in the east. Another scholar. Give me a fatwa. Give me a religious edict. So I can overthrow and topple the Taifa kings. And he did exactly that. He came back for the fourth time in 1092. And set up Almoravid rule. The final point here. I want to stress this home again. You have to tell yourselves this. We would rather be camel herders than swine herders. We would rather live without Wi-Fi, without three meals a day, without having a car, without having our luxurious bedding, and without having your duck-feathered or goose-feathered pillows, without having any of this. You would rather live a life of simplicity, and maybe you might be pushed back into the Stone Ages, then live a life that we're currently living. Sacrifice is the only way forward. And if you want to do that, I mean, this would have linked in with Ibn Khaldun's theory, but we don't have time for that. If you want to do that, if you think it's too late for yourselves, then start with your children. The best way to do that, the best way, John Mann, who is a biographer of Salah al-Din, the book's average, but the end is to die for. At the end, he said, what made Salah al-Din great? His parents, and his parents managed to couch Salah al-Din's life in comfort. They gave him everything. But he was given a healthy dose of insecurity. His parents let him know the world out there is big, bad, and dangerous. His father, Ayub, that was his name. Yusuf was Salah al-Din's name. Yusuf's father, Ayub, said, the world is a big, bad place. He exposed him to a healthy level of insecurity and hardship, so that Salah ad-Din would know, I had a family that looked after me. I had a state that looked after me. The Zengids, they were the ones who backed me and supported me. But at the same time, my father's told me how terrible the world is and I need to change it. And his father weaned him off of luxury. So he wasn't alien to a life of being weathered and worn away. So that healthy dose of insecurity needs to be administered to our children. I'll tell you what, I'll finish on this. How can you do that? It's really, really simple. Send them out in Jamaat. Tabligh. As simple as that. Tabligh is the best way to get your children to be accustomed to a healthy dose of insecurity. Because they'll have to wake up at the crack of dawn for Fajr, which most of them don't do. They have to sleep on the floor on a sleeping bag, which they don't do at home. They'll have to be forced to eat whatever's cooked. They'll be forced to pack away their belongings and put it to one side. They'll be forced to clean up after themselves, which a lot don't do. They'll be forced to adapt to a shift and change in their timetable. They'll be forced to sit through things they don't want to. They need to be forced a little bit. So that's number one, tabligh. And take them back home. Take them back to India for a couple of weeks. Take them back to Bangladesh for a few weeks. Take them back to the Arab world for a few weeks. Let them know what it was like to live there. Yusuf ibn Tashfin, his mulabitun. You know why they were so successful? Their diet consisted of camel milk and camel meat. That's it. Very rarely would they have ever seen bread, unless travelers across the sub-Saharan trade network would have brought them flour and their eyes would have lit up. Wow, flour, bread. Just camel milk and camel meat. That's it. So remember, this is the key takeaway lesson. We would rather be camel herders than swine herders. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow the information to permeate into our brains. And before I forget, I think we should maybe the answers of the trivia very quickly if you've got time. We've got a few minutes, so let me quickly go through that. The reason is because I did have a very simple prize with me, which is the best gift anybody can give, a gift you can open again and again, which was a book. I don't have the book with me because there was a problem with shipping, but it's a book on the Islamic history of Europe. Very simple, 100 pages, written by one of my lecturers. I took a course, a diploma in Islamic history, Dr. Steph Kerris. 100 pages, talks about Muslim Spain, Greece as well, Italy. Muslims had an enclave, a frontier state in Switzerland as well, that lasted for about 100 years. And it forced the Byzantine emperor to actually send a letter to the Umayyad caliph in Cordoba saying, please sort them out. These are Cordoban, these are Andalusian expats who started their own state and they're intercepting our trade caravans, they're proving to be a nuisance. This is a frontier border. They're carrying out jihad in a very unique way. And they cause all sorts of problems. So the book is called Islamic History of Europe. Anyway, let's get through. So question number one was, what was the capital of Muslim Spain? The answer was, I'll give you the answer and you can tick it off if you got it right. And whoever gets the most points, then they can get the prize. Cordoba. Did anybody get that wrong? Okay, who got that right? Just raise your hand so I know. Cordoba, okay, right. We're all level pegging. Number two, which Muslim dynasty ruled the majority of Spain during the Middle Ages? The Umayyad dynasty. The Umayyad dynasty, the western branch in Muslim Spain. Did anybody get that wrong? Okay, so how many got it right? Okay, so two. 2 points so far. Number three, what was the name of the famous palace and fortress complex in Granada? It was the Alhambra Palace, or Qasr al-Hamra, or Al-Qasr al-Hamra. Did anybody get that wrong? Okay, that's impressive, everybody got that right. That is, if you're going to Spain, you have to go to Granada, visit the Alhambra Palace, and you have to go to Cordoba and visit the other site, which we'll talk about in a moment. Number four, what year did the Muslim rule in Spain begin? The answer is 711. With Tariq ibn Ziyad's Blitzkrieg. 711. Did anybody get that wrong? Okay, that's fine. So I think we've got some people who are on 4 for 4. Number five was, who was the first Amir or ruler of Cordoba? This one might have been a little more difficult and tricky. Abdurrahman the First. Abdurrahman al-Dakhil, if you can remember, the immigrant, the foreigner. Abdurrahman. Okay, and the final question was, which significant cultural, religious, and intellectual center was located in Cordoba, and that is in Spanish known as the Mezquita, or the Grand Mosque of Cordoba. Jami' al-Qurtuba, the Grand Mosque, which was unfortunately defaced in the 16th century. Literally, a massive cathedral was just plonked into the middle during the reign of Charles V, who was the Pope and the Emperor. And he said, this was done without his knowledge. And this is obviously to stamp down Christian authority. When he found out, he called the architects and whoever commissioned the job. He gave them a good rollicking and he said, you could have built a cathedral anywhere. Why would you build it on top of the mosque? Because it was a magnificent work of art with its horseshoe arches and alternating patterns of red and yellow limestone and double arches at the top. So that was the Mosque of Cordoba. So we had six questions. Who got six for six? I guess Mufti Sahib's going to be the winner then. So six for six. Okay, who got five? Five for six. Okay, what about four for six? Okay, we've got four people here. Anybody less than that? Four for six? Three for six as well? Two? One? Okay, so we have a conundrum here because it's a level pegging race between four people. Okay, so we'll try and do something for the four people. I'll try and get you all a copy of the book as well, Islamic History of Europe. So just make sure you come to me afterwards so I can get your contact details. So that brings our sessions to an end, to a near closure. And the point of these two sessions was to leave you salivating a little bit, to just lead you on a little bit, just to let you know how much there is out there. And there's an entire world and galaxy that you can explore. And it's just about whether you want to pick up a book and start reading or listen to lectures online. And hopefully this should spur you on. So for next time, instead of finding a holiday in the most soulless, spiritless, empty city in the world, Dubai, then take your holiday destination abroad. Go to Muslim Spain. Go to Turkey if you want. Not seaside resort, go to Istanbul. And the travel guides that can take you around the old sites. Okay, so I'll leave it there. Jazakumullah khairah for listening. And we ask Allah to forgive our sins and to ingrain within our minds. Remember, what was the strap line of the motto? What did we end with? What was Al-Mu'tamid statement in the Arab summit, the Islamic summit in Spain? Come on, this is simple. We would rather be something over something else. I want you guys to echo it back to me. We would rather be camel herders than swine herders. Jazakumullah khair.
Jazakallah khair, and may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept Mufti Sahib's efforts. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala allow us to understand the lessons from history. Just one last thing, our honorable tour guide, Maulana Inamul Hassan Sahib, is with us. So if anybody is interested in joining the trip to Spain, then please, if you want to speak to Maulana Inamul Hassan Sahib, he's here with us, inshallah. Jazakallah khair. Subhanallah, bihamdi, subhanakallah, bihamdi.